This episode of Morbidology is sponsored by Yarn, an interactive storytelling app where stories are told as text messages between the main characters. It offers everything from true crime child fiction stories to even choosing your own adventure. They have series such as Mystery Dog and Haunted Camper, but my favourite has got to be their latest podcast, Strange Street, where you follow the main character, Cece, into a mysterious alternate universe. It had me guessing the entire time. So if you love true crime podcasts, then Yarn is the app for you. Tap through the most addictive and immersive stories today, only on Yarn. Trust me, with over 27 million downloads, Yarn is a must play. Download Yarn for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Y-A-R-N. Download it today to watch, read, and listen to all of your favorite fiction stories. From steamy to horror, Yarn has it all. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. For many people, the all-American dream is to settle down, get married, have a family, and have a successful business. For a lot of people, the Corrigan family from Meridian, Idaho, were the epitome of the all-American dream. For some people, however, nothing is ever enough. And a tragedy in 2011 revealed grim secrets and showed that the grass isn't always greener on the other side. At around 10 p.m. on the 11th of March 2011, police in Meridian, Idaho, were called to a Walgreens parking lot in the 4600 block of North Linder Road. They had received a flurry of phone calls of gunshots fired, with two people reported down outside Walgreens.
An emergency? Do you need police, fire, or paramedics?
I'm saying police.
What's the address of the emergency?
I'm paramedics. I'm driving north on Linda, mm-hmm. And there were three gunshots at the Walgreens on McMillan and Linda. I didn't stop, but because I have two young kids in my car.
At Linda and McMillan, you said there were two gunshots?
Three.
When they arrived on the scene, they discovered a deceased man who had sustained gunshot wounds to the head and chest. He was discovered in the parking lot near the pickup truck, which had the driver's side door wide open. They also found a second man with a superficial gunshot wound to the head. The victim was soon enough identified as 30-year-old Emmett Corrigan from Meridian, a married father. He and his wife, Ashley, had five children together. Both Ashley and the children absolutely doted on Emmett. As Ashley said, "He loved being a dad as much as I loved being a mom." The couple had met in a gym in college in 2003. After just 6 months together, they were married. Ashley sat down and spoke with Crime Watch Daily about their relationship.
"We were dating like 2 months. We dated really fast and we both just kind of knew it was what we wanted.
Emmett had attended Utah State University and Gozanga Law School before serving as an intern in the Ada County Public Defender's Office. Emmett had passed the bar exam in October of the previous year and had just branched out on his own and opened his own criminal defense law office in Boise. Emmett was in the prime of his life and just starting out his professional career. DC Carr, a longtime criminal defense attorney who had worked with Emmett, said that he was always extremely helpful and nice and was very approachable. He stated, "He hadn't had that much experience, but I've done criminal law for 20 years and can tell when someone loves it. Emmett was one I could tell was going to stay with it." Investigators quickly announced that they believed the second man with the superficial gunshot wound to the head was a suspect in the shooting. The second man wasn't immediately identified, but investigators announced that he was rushed to a local hospital for his wounds to be treated, and that they believed that the murder had been the result of some kind of domestic issue. They said that the suspect had been armed with a gun and that he and Emmett had struggled over the gun. They weren't yet sure whether the suspect had been shot in the struggle or whether he inflicted the wound on himself. The following day, the suspect was identified as 42-year-old Robert Hall, who worked for the Ada County Sheriff's Office as a technical support person for mapping systems used by dispatchers, and he was arrested on suspicion of murder. Meridian Deputy Police Chief Tracy Bastaricha said that Robert would very likely be charged with first-degree murder upon his release from hospital. His injury was not considered life-threatening. When the suspect was identified, it was further revealed that the domestic dispute was over a woman. It was revealed that Robert's wife, Candy Hall, had met with Emmett in the Walgreens parking lot. Robert was at the parking lot, armed and waiting for them when the confrontation broke out. The following day, Robert was discharged from the hospital and was charged with first-degree murder. When announcing the update, Sheriff Gary Rainey said, "This is a sad reminder how a decision based solely on emotion can ruin many lives and a career. Two families were forever affected. Children left without their fathers. Those children and these two families are in our thoughts and prayers during this very difficult time." While investigators were remaining tight-lipped on the events surrounding the murder, Emmett's brother spoke with the media and said that in the days leading up to Emmett's murder, he had confided in him that he was being stalked by Robert. His brother Jason said that Emmett told him that Robert had accused him of having an affair with his wife, Candy, who worked in Emmett's office as his assistant. Emmett had confided in Jason that Robert had been stalking him. He would randomly show up at his house, at the mall when he was there, or in front of his work, and he couldn't understand how he kept finding him. Jason said that he didn't know the specifics of the relationship between his brother and Robert's wife, but said that just the day before the shooting, he had filed divorce paperwork on behalf of her. As mentioned, Robert had worked on mapping projects for the sheriff's office, including an automatic vehicle locator software program, which would track the location of an ambulance and police cars on maps for dispatchers. Jason suggested that Robert had used some kind of tracking device to pinpoint Emmett's whereabouts. According to Sheriff's spokeswoman, Andrea Dearden, there was no evidence that Robert had used some kind of tracking device, but said that investigators would follow up every single lead and tip. The following day, Robert appeared in court to be formally charged. While prosecutors did not speak about the motivation behind the murder, they offered a bit more information. They confirmed that Robert's wife Candy did work for Emmett and that she had given more insight into what transpired that night.
Are you Candy?
Yeah.
Please help us put this together as best as we can
We'll match statements with evidence. I mean, you know how police work goes.
I know. I do it all day long. Okay. Rob, my husband, has he has had a really hard time with me working with Emmett. Emmett being younger and, you know, aggressive attorney. And I have been working with him since October.
Are you and Emmett involved in a romantic relationship?
No.
Emmett?
No.
Okay, now let's say sexual. Have you been sexual with Emmett?
No. I went and got gas at Fred Meyer with Emmett, and then we were driving back. My daughter called me, and she said, "Mom, where are you?" And I told her I was with Michelle, and that is my best friend, Michelle, because I didn't want to tell her that, who I was with. So then Rob calls, and he calls me, and I pick up, and he's like, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I am out." He said, "Are you out with Emmett?" And I said, "I am." And he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "We're just talking." And then Emmett goes, "Let me talk to him." And then Emmett got really upset with Rob on the phone and said something like, "I'll break your head."
Candy said that she and Emmett had met in the parking lot of Walgreens on the night of the murder. Somehow Robert found out that they were together and called Candy, who confirmed that she was with Robert and that she would be returning to the Walgreens parking lot shortly. According to prosecutors, Robert grabbed his semi-automatic handgun and went to the Walgreens parking lot, where he lay in wait for Candy and Emmett to return.
Emmett got out of the truck, and I got out, and I stood there, and Rob came up, and Emmett's a very aggressive man. He bodybuilds, you know, so he's really pumped up all the time, and he got like this close up into Rob's face, and I remember, and I'm all, "Hey, knock it off! This is ridiculous!" And I hear pop, pop, and then pop, and then all I heard, and I turn around, and both of them are laying on the ground, and then I ran over it, and I was like, I was pretty stunned at that point. I thought, what in the world? Because I didn't even know what the pop pop was. It almost sounded like a balloons popping. Emmett was kind of like on his, like this. And I didn't know what was going on. And I just see all this blood gushing down his rough face. So I went over and I covered. He had this wound on the top of his head, not covered. And I'm calling 911.
Emmett and Robert both got out of their cars, and Candy said that a verbal confrontation ensued before Robert shot Emmett in the head and chest. After killing Emmett, Robert shot himself once in the head, but it was only a superficial wound. While the investigation was still underway, prosecutors announced that they had gathered enough evidence to show that the murder was premeditated, and therefore constituted as first-degree murder. When Robert was interviewed following the shooting, he first of all tried to claim that the gun had fallen out of his pocket during a scuffle, and he wasn't sure how Emmett had been shot. However, a number of witnesses, including Candy and passing motorists, refuted this and said that there was no scuffle. There was only a verbal altercation before Robert opened fire. Candy and Robert had moved to Meridian from Southern California in 2006. The couple had first met while at a local gym. As Candy said, they both connected instantly. By the time they moved to Meridian, they had been together for years and had two beautiful children. In Meridian, Candy's career as a paralegal took off, and she was confident in her job. Sophia Cerna, who worked alongside Candy, said that it didn't hurt that she was attractive as well. However, there was trouble in paradise, and Robert soon became short and snappy. Then one night he confessed to Candy that he had been having an affair, but he wanted to fix things. Robert told Candy he was dedicated to her and the affair had just been a lapse of judgment. Robert, however, couldn't stop the affair. Candy's confidence crumbled, so when she started working for Emmett, who was 10 years her junior, and he began to show her attention, Candy couldn't help herself. As Candy later said, I would like to be put on that pedestal. Emmett made me feel that way. That was pretty much an ego boost for me. Towards the end of the month, there was an extremely unexpected update in the case, when it was announced that Robert had posted a $1 million bail bond and was released from the Ada County Jail. He had used a bail bond service to post a surety bond, which meant that he didn't actually put down $1 million in cash. Bond agencies typically require somebody to pay 10% of the bond to be released, and they typically don't get that money back regardless of how the case ends up. This meant that Robert would remain out of custody until the resolution of the case. The court records for his bond showed no contact orders between Robert and Candy, who would very likely be the star witness during the trial. The fact that Robert, who had been charged with first-degree murder, was released, understandably led to a lot of angry reactions, not only from Emmett's family, but from strangers as well. Emmett's brother Jason said that he felt sick to his stomach when he learned that Robert had been released on bond. He said he believed that there was no chance that Robert would be able to post bond. One neighbour of Robert, who asked to remain anonymous, said he felt terrified that Robert was back living in the neighbourhood and that he was afraid of letting his child walk to school alone anymore. He said, "We're fearful. He's obviously got nothing to lose. Who knows when he's going to snap next?" Following his release, the Attorney General's office filed a motion asking a district court to impose three conditions on Robert, including that he have no contact with Candy or Emmett's wife, Ashley, and that he surrender his passport and remain in Ada County. The conditions were approved, and in addition, Robert was ordered to wear an electronic tracking bracelet to make sure that he wasn't breaching these conditions. When these conditions were approved, it was revealed that since his release, Robert had been living at the family home with Candy, who was the main eyewitness to the murder and who would very likely be the key witness during the trial. It would also be revealed during the hearing that Aladdin Bail Bonds had agreed to post the $1 million bond for an initial payment of just $20,000, which was $80,000 less than the 10% standard charge, which is usually required by such bail bond companies. In mid-April, Robert pleaded not guilty to the murder of Emmett, and it was announced that the prosecution would not be seeking the death penalty. In court, Candy asked if she would be allowed contact with Robert. She asked that they be allowed to attend church together, to go to athletic contests together for their children, and to have three phone calls per week, where they were only allowed to speak about their children and then have family dinner on Sunday. The judge declined to hear the issue. The prosecution stated that when the shooting happened, the relationship between Candy and Robert was in turmoil. They revealed that in the hours before the shooting, Candy and Emmett had met with a public defender to inquire about how to get a protective order against Robert and how to file for divorce. Furthermore, according to a colleague of Candy, she had spotted numerous bruises on her beforehand and had feared that she was being abused by her husband. The judge would ultimately deny Candy's request because she was an eyewitness to the murder. The following month, Candy was arrested for felony grand theft by possession. She was accused of stealing more than $30,000 from a previous employer who was not Emmett. Investigators announced that they had uncovered evidence that Candy had taken out around $32,000 in payments from clients of that lawyer and then put them directly into her own PayPal account, from which she then transferred the money to a debit card with a different account, both of which were under her name. The following day, Candy posted a $100,000 bond. With both cases making their way through the justice system, in September, it was announced that Robert may be sent back to jail for violating the conditions of his release. According to the prosecution, Robert had knowingly and deliberately had contact with Candy on at least 18 separate occasions. On the 13th of September, Robert was ordered back to court, where his bond was revoked, which meant that he was heading back to jail. Then in January, Candy was once again arrested on a new charge, a felony, offering a forged document into evidence. According to prosecutors, Candy had forged a letter from her boss and entered it into evidence in her grand theft case. She had written the letter as if it were from Jared Martin, who was her old boss, and said that he would use the account to deposit Candy's quarterly bonuses and clothing allowances. She once again posted bond and was now facing two felony charges, one for grand theft and one for preparing false evidence. In April, Candy admitted to stealing more than $1,000 from Jared, her old employer. She appeared in court where she pleaded guilty to grand theft as part of a plea agreement with the prosecutors who agreed to drop the charges of forging documents. Grand theft was punishable by up to 14 years in prison, and the plea agreement did not include any kind of deal on a recommended sentence. When Candy was asked if she had anything to say, she said no. Candy's sentencing phase was pushed back because Judge Timothy Hansen said that she needed a thorough mental health evaluation. She had already been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, which had stemmed from witnessing the murder of Emmett. Meanwhile, Robert was ordered to stand trial in October. But 2 months before the trial, attorneys for both the state and Robert filed with the court intentions to use mediation before the trial. Mediation was a new method for criminal cases in Idaho, and it was an unusual move. Mediation is a formal way of resolving a case without the help of an approved outside judge, and would mean that the case would be resolved without going to trial. In fact, it was the first time in Idaho history that mediation had been employed in a murder trial. Ultimately, however, the mediation attempt failed, and the trial would go ahead in October of 2012. Up until now, very little information regarding the murder case had been revealed. During opening statements, Idaho Attorney General Jessica Lorello told the jury that the murder had occurred just hours after Candy told Robert she had seen a divorce lawyer. She further stated that Candy and Emmett had been having an affair for months, and both of them had been telling other people that they were going to leave their spouses so that they could be together. She said, "The evidence will show that Hall did not shoot Emmett Corrigan in self-defense. The defendant is the one who waited for Emmett Corrigan. The defendant is the one who brought a gun to confront Corrigan with. The defendant fired shots from 2 to 3 feet away." Her opening statement was very brief, only lasting around 10 minutes. Defense attorneys Rob Chastain and Deb Crystal declined to present an opening statement and reserved the right to do one later when they put forward their defense. Much of the testimony on the first day of the trial focused on evidence that was collected at the crime scene, while graphic photographs of Emmett's body were shown to the jury. Afterwards, 5 witnesses who lived near the Walgreens at the time of the shooting or driving past the scene were called to testify. They all said that they heard 3 gunshots at around 10 p.m. that night, while 3 witnesses recollected hearing yelling, including 1 witness who heard a woman's voice shouting, "You shot him in the head." The key witness in the trial would be Candy, who finally admitted that she had been having an affair with Emmett, her boss. She said the affair began 2 months after she started to work as a paralegal in his new law office. She said that on the night he was killed, they had sex in Emmett's truck. She took the jury through the night of the murder, stating that Emmett and Robert had gotten into a verbal altercation in the parking lot, which ended in 3 shots. She said that Emmett was verbally aggressive and had shoved Robert, almost knocking him down. She told the jury that she had got in between Emmett and Robert and told them to stop fighting. She said that she then walked towards the car and asked Robert to follow her, but then the 3 shots rang out. Under cross-examination, prosecutor Jason Spillman reminded Candy that when she was first questioned 2 hours after the shooting, She said that there was no kind of physical altercation before the shooting took place. Candy replied by saying, "Things come back to me all the time." Candy had also testified that she heard three shots. A pop, then a pause, then two more pops. And turned around to see Robert bleeding on the ground with Emmett's body a short distance away. However, when Candy was first interviewed, she told investigators that the sequence of shots was pop, pop, pause, and then a third pop. This account supported the prosecution's theory that Robert murdered Emmett for the affair, and then attempted to end his own life. While on the witness stand, Candy also told the jury that she was never planning on leaving Robert, and that he had never abused her, and he most likely didn't even know about the affair until the night of the shooting. Once again, under cross-examination, Candy was accused of lying. The story she was telling on the witness stand was completely different than the story she told investigators 2 hours after the shooting had occurred. It would also be revealed that Candy had told investigators in the wake of the shooting that Robert had abused her, but now she stated, "If I ever said he was physical with me, it was a lie. It was just another lie of mine to make my home situation look bad." By this point in the trial, Candy had been seriously discredited, and her testimony couldn't be taken as truth. The judge said,
"Frankly, any testimony by Ms. Hall, in my 31 years on the bench, I don't think I've seen a witness more thoroughly discredited in the course of a proceeding."
It was also revealed that Robert had sent a letter to Ashley informing her of her husband's affair with his wife, which was evidence that Robert certainly did know about the affair before the shooting. Furthermore, Candy was presented with an email which had been sent to her from Robert on the 2nd of January, in which it was evident that Robert knew about the affair. He wrote, "Good luck with Emmett. Once honeymoon is over, you will be left with nothing. Karma is a bitch, and I will have the last laugh." Candy would also be presented with an email she had sent to her mother in January of 2011, which read, "I just really want to run away, Mom. The only thing that has been good in my life with Robert has been the birth of my children." When prosecutor Jason Spillman suggested to Candy that her version of events had changed after talking to her husband following his release from jail, she became indignant and stated, "I did not talk to him about what happened at the shooting, ever." While Candy was called as a prosecution witness, she came across as more of a defense witness. She told the jury that Emmett was aggressive, angry, and even obsessed with the idea that she should leave her husband to be with him. She said that he repeatedly sent her text messages and emails, and that she would never leave her husband of 18 years, because she was in love with him, despite the fact that she was having an affair with Emmett. She said that when the argument began in the parking lot of Walgreens that night, she feared for her husband's safety, because Emmett was a weightlifter and a fitness enthusiast. Under further cross-examination, it was revealed that shortly after the murder, Candy had told her husband, "I'm going to make this better. This isn't my first rodeo with the law. I know what I'm doing. I'm going to get you vindicated." Prosecutors would not reveal who reported these statements, but Candy claimed that she did not remember making the statements. Candy also testified that she was committed to her marriage with Robert, and that she had gifted him the murder weapon back in December of 2009. Today's sponsor is Care Of, which is a wellness brand which makes it simple to maintain health goals with a customized vitamin plan. All of their products are formulated with clean ingredients backed by science. They're super transparent about the research and sourcing behind each product. At Care Of, you do an online quiz about your diet, lifestyle, and health concerns to help address your specific wellness goals. And then your recommendations come in daily individual wrapped packets that takes the hassle out of purchasing numerous bottles of vitamins. It couldn't be any simpler to take control of your health with Care Of. The Morbidology listeners get a special promo code. for 50% off your first care-off order. Go to takecareof.com and enter code MORBIDOLOGY50. That is promo code MORBIDOLOGY50 at takecareof.com. The link is in the show notes. As I'm sure all of you true crime podcast fans are aware, sometimes you need a little break from all of the negativity and something to take the edge off. Well, what better than a mobile puzzle game filled with cute characters? I'm sure you've already heard of Best Fiends. There's over 100 million global downloads, and it seems like everyone is playing it, and I think that you should be too. They've sponsored today's episode of Morbidology. As you progress through the game, you collect cute little monsters that you can then evolve. Best Fiends is easy to follow and fun to play, making it the perfect game for both adults and children. It's a casual game that won't stress you out. It's very easy to pass the time with. I find myself playing it mostly before bed and between writing scripts. I'm already on level 254. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters. Trust me, with over 100 million downloads, this 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. Download Best Fiends for free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends. Her testimony would be followed by testimony from Eagle Police Chief Dana Borquist, who was friends with Robert. According to Dana, Robert had told him that he and Candy had discussed the letter that he sent to Ashley, and how Emmett would have been mad about it. He also said that Robert had known about the affair for months and was contemplating divorce. He had even rented a house where he planned on living with the couple's children. Candy's neighbour, Tabitha Butterworth, and Meridian police officer Natalie Chopko, then testified that following the shooting, Candy had told them that the argument was verbal, not physical. Ashley, Emmett's former wife, was also called to testify during the trial. Since the shooting, she had remarried and was now Ashley Burke. On the witness stand, she told the jury that she had suspected something was amiss in her relationship with Emmett, but she never had any evidence that he was having an affair. Deep down, however, Ashley knew. Emmett had stopped coming home on occasion, and their son had even asked her if he still lived with them anymore. Ashley spoke with Crime Watch Daily about this.
I started thinking, there's got to be another woman or something. And the kids were starting to say, does he live here anymore? He's always at work.
She detailed the evening of the murder, stating that she had made Emmett's favourite dinner and then had family time with the children. She spoke with a relative on the phone who was also a counsellor, and while on the phone, Emmett came into the bedroom and told her that he was running to Walgreens. Ashley said that she asked Emmett to stay a minute and they could talk about what the relative said and try to work on their marriage. But Emmett said no, that he needed to go to Walgreens. Forensic evidence was presented on the fifth day of the trial. The murder weapon, which was Robert's gun, was shown to the jury. It was revealed that there was only one recovered fingerprint from the murder weapon, and it was Candy's. DNA from the blood on the gun was from Robert. However, there was someone else's DNA on the gun as well, and forensic scientists couldn't rule out that it was Emmett's. They had tested the hands of Emmett, Robert, and Candy, and found gunshot residue on all of them. Robert had markedly more particles of residue on his hands than both Candy and Emmett. Forensic scientist Alison Murtha said, with the finding of this population of particles, those three component particles could have come from the fact that this subject discharged a firearm, was in close proximity when a firearm was discharged, or came into contact with something that had gunshot residue on it. CCTV footage from the parking lot and inside the Walgreens was also presented. While it didn't capture the shooting, it showed some of what happened before and after the shooting. At around 9 p.m, the CCTV camera picked up Candy pulling into the parking lot, followed by Emmett. 8 minutes later, Candy pulls into a parking space and gets out of the car. She testifies that she got into Emmett's truck, but the CCTV cameras didn't pick that up. Then shortly before 10 p.m, Robert is seen pulling into the parking lot and parking beside his wife's car. He enters the Walgreens, walks around the aisles, goes back outside and walks around the parking lot. Just after 10 p.m, Robert got back into his car and moved it to the other side of Candy's car. At 10:12 p.m, Emmett's truck returns to the parking lot. Robert's light in his car goes on and then off. Nothing else can be seen on the CCTV footage until 10:23 p.m, when the first police officers arrive. The pathologist who conducted Emmett's autopsy testified that he couldn't determine whether Emmett had been shot in the head or chest first, but said that when he was hit in the chest, he dropped immediately to the ground. He said that it was impossible to tell if the same bullet that grazed Robert in the head could have hit Emmett, which was a theory that the defense would be putting forward. He testified the toxicology reports showed that Emmett had both steroids and amphetamines, which could have been Adderall in his system at the time of the shooting. After the prosecution rested their case, the defense asked the judge to throw out the case due to lack of evidence. Defense attorney Rob Chastain said, "The state is long on motive, long on opportunity, and long on impeachment, but they are short on any substantive evidence." Judge Michael McLaughlin disagreed and said that the prosecution had provided jurors with substantial evidence. He denied their request, and it was now their time to present the defense of Robert. They would desperately be attempting to poke holes in the prosecution's case. Defense Chastain provided a short opening statement in which he said that the prosecution had failed to prove that Robert had planned on murdering Emmett that night. The jury would hear for the first time Robert speaking about the shooting in a recorded interview from hospital following the shooting. While responding to questions from investigators, Robert said that he wasn't sure how Emmett got shot. His speech was slow and slurred as he told investigators that the gun had fallen out of his pocket and he and Emmett fought over it. When investigators asked Robert what he was doing at the Walgreens parking lot, he told them that his daughter had told him that Candy was there with her boss. He told investigators that Emmett told him that he had mistreated his wife, and an argument ensued. According to Robert Friedman, a physician at Idaho Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, Robert had experienced a moderate concussion which had led to some memory loss. The jury would next hear from Pablo Stewart, a psychiatrist, who said that at the time of the shooting, Emmett was experiencing symptoms from steroid use, which included impulsiveness and irritability. The defense also called on Kay Sweeney, a forensic scientist, who said that after looking at the bullet holes recovered from Emmett's body, there was a high degree of possibility that the bullet that hit Emmett in the chest was the same bullet that hit Robert in the head. He said that the bullet to Emmett's chest showed signs that it had hit something else first, and the only piece of evidence on the scene was that it hit Robert's head. The forensic scientist also called into question the earlier testimony regarding the gunshot residue evidence, which showed that Robert had the most on his hands. He stated, "There's just no evidence to identify specifically who fired it." The prosecution refuted this and said that the forensic scientists did not conduct autopsies and were not qualified to make these claims. They called on a rebuttal witness, pathologist Glenn Grobin, who dismissed the ricochet claim, stating that forensic analysis showed that the hollow point bullets in Robert's gun and the angle at which they were fired would not allow this to happen. He stated, unequivocally, that is not, there is absolutely no physical evidence that fits with that scenario. You would have to say that the bullet, that the characteristic of that bullet, that the way it looked, was consistent with him hitting his head first. You cannot say that. While Emmett's wife had testified as a prosecution witness, she also testified that she had suspected that Emmett had been using steroids. And when she told him that she had asked her brother and sister to pray for them, he responded by saying that he would beat up her brother and kill them all. She testified that in addition to the steroids, Emmett had been taking medication for attention deficit hyperactive disorder, which was a stimulant. Hannah Hall, Candy, and Robert's daughter, told the jury that before the shooting occurred, her father had been packing boxes as if he were going to move out. She said that she told her father that she had seen her mother's car at Walgreens parking lot that night, and that he appeared to be sad, not angry. Text messages were also presented from that night from Emmett, in which he told one of Candy's family members that he was going to beat up Robert, and that he wouldn't let him lay a finger on Candy ever again. A phone call was also entered as evidence, which was between Robert and his mother from jail. In that phone call, Robert said that he didn't realise that Emmett had been using steroids. During closing arguments, prosecutor Jason Spillman told the jury that Robert had hunted Emmett down, waited in the parking lot for Candy and Emmett to come back to the car, and then shot and executed Emmett. He said, "There is no credible evidence that the argument between Hall and Corrigan ever became physical, or that Emmett Corrigan ever laid a finger on Hall. What was the defendant doing at Walgreens? He was hunting." He said that the gunpowder residue found on Robert's hands and the lack of gunpowder residue found on Emmett's hands was a clear indication that Robert had pulled the trigger. He also informed the jury that it takes 7 pounds of pressure to pull a trigger, and to use their common sense, highlighting that it was extremely unlikely that the gun could have gone off accidentally. Defence Chastain said during the closing arguments that the prosecution had presented no evidence, no eyewitness testimony, and no footage, which showed exactly what happened that night. He said that the most likely scenario was that an aggressive Emmett, who was very protective of Candy, was under the influence of steroids and attacked Robert that night, with the gun discharging during the struggle. He stated, "Nobody can prove that Rob Hall controlled the gun when Emmett Corrigan was shot. Emmett fought with Hall and the gun fell out of his pocket. The case is absolutely consistent with self-defense." After the prosecution and defence rested their cases, it was time for the jury to deliberate. Did Robert go to the Walgreens parking lot with the intention to kill Emmett? Or was the shooting an accident or in self-defence? The jury would deliberate for just 7 hours before returning with a verdict.
Has the jury reached a unanimous verdict?
Yeah.
And Mr. Hall, if you could please stand. Is Robert Dean Hall guilty or not guilty of second-degree murder? Guilty.
They found Robert Hall guilty of second-degree murder as opposed to first-degree murder. While Emmett's family did not provide a statement following the verdict, prosecutor Spillman said that they wanted him to relay that justice had been done. A second-degree murder conviction is punishable by a sentence of 10 years up to life in prison. Before the sentencing phase, Robert asked for a new trial. He contended that the jury's guilty verdict was not supported by the evidence that was presented during trial. The judge would deny the motion, stating that there was substantial evidence of second-degree murder. In early December, Candy was handed a 14-year prison sentence, but could apply for parole after 2 years. Judge Timothy Hansen then ordered Candy to spend at least 6 months in an Idaho Department of Correction Treatment program before a judge would decide whether she would go to prison for grand theft. This was known as Retained Jurisdiction Program. Her victim, which was her former boss, stated, "I'm satisfied with the sentence, simply because I don't think she will be able to follow it. I know her. Not being able to have fancy glasses of wine or credit cards. Any attempt to follow the rules of probation will be torture to her." Then the following month, the sentencing phase for Robert was pushed back, so the prosecutors could spend more time examining a mental health evaluation, which determined that Robert was suffering from depression and would be a low risk to re-offend if ever released back into society. Judge Michael McLaughlin said that it wasn't a surprise that Robert was suffering from depression. He had been involved in a murder, was in jail, and was separated from his family. He questioned why a delay in the case was needed, but Prosecutor Spillman said that he wanted a second mental health expert to go over the evaluation. Robert was back in court in mid-March for the sentencing phase. Emmett's mother and father provided victim impact statements and relayed how the murder of their son had completely torn their lives apart.
Second, you took out that gun, had the holster, you already knew what you were going to do with it. Then you killed my son.
Fine, Miss Lyman. I need a computer. And he should be here.
Ashley also gave an impact statement and said the shooting didn't just end an affair or a lie. It ended her family. She said, Emmett was greeted every night by 10 tiny hands. He was our little girl's protector and my son's superhero. I never thought I would be teaching my babies what murder is before they knew how to spell.
This is a picture I took. I think it was about a week before Emmett died. The night itself was a traumatic event for each of us, and the 2 years that have followed have brought much pain. I've tried to figure out how, and without hearing I'm sorry, Emmett's chance to say I'm sorry isn't here. I can tell you about my babies pounding on a casket. Their hero's body lying inside, screaming for him to wake up and screaming at me because I was the thing telling him that we couldn't open the box. I could tell of nights of them screaming in their beds because they had a dream that the bad guy came to their house and shot them in the head.
Robert Hall was sentenced to 30 years in prison, and Judge McLaughlin ordered that Robert serve at least 17 and a half years before being eligible for parole. He was given credit for the last 18 months he had spent in jail. Robert was given the opportunity to speak, and he said that he was so sorry for what had happened. He once again did not acknowledge that he had shot Emmett on purpose, but instead, he apologized for the shockwaves that his actions had caused Emmett's family, as well as his own family. Speaking of Emmett's parents, he said, "No parent should ever have to bury their child." Candy's sentence for charges of grand theft and computer fraud were reduced. She was ordered to serve 18 months before being eligible for parole. She was released from prison in 2014. Robert Hall still denies that he murdered Emmett that night, and still maintains that Emmett was the aggressor. He spoke with Keith Morrison in the hours after the sentencing and said, "I don't think I made 4 steps before I was ripped off my feet. When I hit the ground, first thing I thought is my cell phone hit the ground, and I looked over and it was my gun. Corrigan reached down and grabbed my gun, and we just struggled over it. Last thing I remember was the gun pointed at my head, and the feeling of being hit upside the head with a baseball bat. Then I remember seeing everything black and grey. And that's all I remember until Sunday in the hospital." Candy Hall still denies that she witnessed the shooting that night. Her version of events has changed several times, and she went from claiming that Robert was abusive to claiming that she had made the abuse claims up. So was Candy a battered wife? While she denies it, several of her colleagues would report seeing bruises on her body, and report hearing Robert screaming at her down the phone. Despite this, Candy has stood by Robert and defended him. She later said, "He knew, and he still knows in his heart, that I've never stopped loving him. You just don't stop loving someone." Emmett's former wife, Ashley, has gone on to remarry and write a book titled The Moments We Stand, which is about her ordeal and the process of healing from such a tragedy.
Life is full of moments. Some we will always remember. Others we will spend a lifetime trying to forget. But it is in these moments we find out who we are and who we were created to be. My name is Ashley. This is my story. On March 11th, 2011, I was made a widow by two shots of a gun. That night, I came head-to-head with many realities. I had five children, the youngest not quite 2 months old, who no longer had a father. I had to continue living in a world that was now full of fear. And I had to face the fact that my husband was killed for sleeping with another man's wife. But most of all, I had to face the reality that I wasn't enough. I wasn't enough for that gun, for that man, or the other woman. But even worse, my husband didn't die fighting for me. He died fighting for her. Anger filled my soul, even more than the pain. Hatred beckoned me to believe the lies that now had me face to face. I was humiliated that the world heard the truth in the same moment I had. I was scared I was no longer lovable, but the biggest battle was the journey to forgive. For 2 years, I tried to sweep my pain under a rug and pretend I wasn't dying inside, but I was broken. I waited for the murder trial to bring me the peace I craved. As the trial ended and nothing changed for me, I realized my journey to heal had just begun. In January 2014, a blog was born. After much inspiration that healing could come for me, I began to write. At first, I thought it would just be a log of all the wrong that had been done to me. But as the words filled the screen, I was finally blessed to see. To forgive is to set a prisoner free and realize the prisoner was you. My journey to find peace had just begun, and it continues on today. Hate, bitterness, anger, fear, those are the things holding us back in our lives, not the past. Everyone has a story, but it is up to each of us individually to write how it is going to end. Let your fear of losing in life stop you from living it. My name is Ashley. I am a survivor of infidelity and murder, and I choose to stand.
The murder of Emmett Corrigan was a chilling reminder that the ripple effects of someone else's actions is much larger than anybody can even begin to fathom. In a matter of just a few seconds, in a lonely parking lot outside Walgreens, the lives of two families were forever shattered. Seven children were left without a father. One was buried in the ground, while the other was behind bars. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big, massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Jai Smith, Christine Braddock, Katie Wiley, and Terry Torgerson. Morbidology now has exclusive merch on Patreon, including t-shirts, stickers, pins, badges, fridge magnets, and keyrings. So if you'd like to join me on Patreon for that, as well as exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, ad-free and early release episodes, and much, much more, then click the link to Patreon that's in my show notes. As you all know, Morbidology is a one-woman team, and the support on there truly helps out. It helps to defray the cost of freedom of information requests, which truly make Morbidology episodes as detailed as they are. Archive subscriptions, hosting, and much, much more. You can join for as little as $1 a month, and you can cancel any time. There's no obligation to stay subscribed. As you all know, I have a new investigative true crime series, which is about the unsolved murder of Jacqueline Dwallaby. It's called The Shattered Window, and it covers the case in 10 episodes. The final episode is out today, so if you've been waiting to binge the entire series, then go ahead. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Excuse Me, That's Illegal. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Oh, hey there. You like true crime stories, right? Yeah, I know, who doesn't? But I gotta admit, after a while, all those stories of murder and heartache, well, they tend to go straight to my hips. So that's why I, Leroy Luna, have created a podcast called Excuse Me, That's Illegal, where we'll take a hardcore look at some softcore crimes. No TED Talks on Bundy here. The letters BTK won't be coming from these lips. Unless he had a brother that used to steal library books. Suppose I'd be willing to go balls deep into that one if that were the case. Anyways, you'll hear stories such as the Mad Pooper, a female jogger who wreaked havoc in a Colorado Springs neighborhood, using one family's front yard as her own personal dumping grounds. If this kind of content sounds like it's up your alley, Excuse Me, That's Illegal, is available right now on all your favorite podcatchers. So come join me.
I'll be right here waiting for you.